How do we want to do this one?
I don't know how to start. How to start? I mean, do people like sad stories? Do people like this kind of truth? Or would they rather not have this? And maybe we start there.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On today's episode, we're talking about Stolen Pleasures by Gina Berriolt. Yes, you heard that correctly. We are talking about a story by Gina Berriolt again. If you've listened to this podcast before, you know that we love short stories and that we hold the stories of Gina Berriolt in such high regard, they sort of set the standard. Stolen Pleasures is a story about two sisters. Floor is 7 years older than Delia. We meet them in childhood, but the story jumps to their adult lives and back again. One sister survives being hit by a car. She has a lazy eye and grows up in a home without a piano, perhaps without many things that both sisters want. The other sister survives scarlet fever, and she wants for more, too. The sisters have a blind mother and a father who had been labeled as a black sheep in his family. These are some of the things we know about these characters, but we learn them incrementally, gradually. And it would seem there are many secrets about stolen pleasures for which we know very little, if anything at all. As Peter Orner surmises, Berriolt has a knack for taking ordinary characters and situations and imbuing them with a fullness and a dignity that maybe all the rest of us want and deserve too. There's something powerfully emotional in that. This is the way that Berriolt manages her characters, these outsiders, suffering the losses of goals that they can't quite name but that they hunger for just the same. As with all of Berriolt's stories, discussing stolen pleasures for Peter Orner and me is simply not an easy thing. Our emotions are high and settle in our throats about this story that is the furthest thing from maudlin or mawkish. Not a bit of that here. In fact, in our discussion, I conclude that it is knowing that Berriolt may only want to depict truth and honesty in these stories. In a world where there is so little truth and honesty, well, I just admire that so much. As I said, emotions run high in this one. As Peter Orner says, Berriolt can take sensational situations and make them subtle. It's in that subtlety that the poignancy can speak to us. We like to say we geek out over stories on The Lonely Voice. Indeed. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss Stolen Pleasures by Gina Berriolt. Yeah, I think people who admire short stories expect the pathos, you know, the sadness and the darkness, the outsiders. Don't you think so too?
I don't know. I think certain writers like Berriolt, the Buse, you know, they're too much, you know. For a lot of people, and that for good reason. I mean, this and maybe we just shouldn't beat around the bush. I mean, I feel like this is one of those stories that is just, you know, it's up there with the very, very, very greatest stories that I know of. I mean, and I know we're not supposed to be hyperbolic, and yet we always are. This one, I just you know, it's a devastating and beautiful and just the kind of honesty that you don't see anywhere, much even in good stories, even in great stories. I think this is you know, this moves to another level. I think it's a very odd, I see, I'm we're going in circles. I don't know what I'm saying.
No.
One thing I thought of was, you know, the opening line of the Ford Madox Ford novel The Good Soldier, where he says, "This is the saddest story I've ever heard." Or something along those lines. You know, you could say that about this story. This is one of the sadder ones, and not that you know, there are more devastating conclusions. There are, you know, nobody dies in the story of the two principal characters here. You know, it's not that kind of story either. It's just a story about life not reaching your expectations, or even close. And how many people experience this? Most of us, maybe, right?
Yes. You know, I think the story is But consistently, I'm finding with rereading Barry Alt again for the millionth time is I really can't find anybody else that's like this, right? And I feel like, is it, am I drawn to them because they are so sad, or there's, what is it? No, and I'm just going to say it's really the writing that just, and that sounds so stupid. I'm not thinking about the writing when I fall into the story. It's just what she manages to make me think about. I think that's what I'm drawn to these days. When I interviewed Lori Siegel, she said, I just want to try to explain what something felt like. That's what I'm trying to do in my stories. I want people to know what it felt like, what it was like. And I feel like with Barry Alt, that's what I'm kind of getting from her, and I'm sort of always chasing now. But this story, I have to say, I've read the story maybe three times in the last couple of weeks, and I read it again this morning, and I mean, I read it a few days ago, and I read it again this morning, and it just was punching me in the head the whole time. You know, it's like you just can't become inured to the emotion and to these experiences that are playing out on the page. All of that is stupid, but I'm just not, I don't know. I'm not getting a handle on how to talk about the story except to say how great it is. Here are two sisters, 7 years apart, and something really terrible happens to them when they're young in the same year. And there's a lot that they suffer from together because of their home life and their parents. And then you can see, I mean, they're 7 years apart. To me, that's a lot of years. You can see how in the ways that they diverge. And then, of course, they diverge in terms of their life experiences. But then how much what the imprint is for them is still so present. That by the end of the story, it's like they're still those same little girls, ashamed of this, wanting that, not getting the other together. Even though their paths diverge and one gets to experience life in a very different way than the other, when they come together, it's like they have still such a connection and such a simpatico, and that's also stupid.
It's not stupid. And you know, this is a, I think you hit it. This is a hard story to talk about. And, you know, to my mind, it's one of the great stories of siblings that I've ever read. And again, I can't avoid the hyperbole because of this particular story. And why are we returning to Barry Alt? Because I think we, maybe both of us lately, are hungry for the best of the best. And, you know, when we talk about other story writers who are great, they're not. Barry Alt is in a place by herself, and that's just the, you know, and maybe we're the only two that believe this. But it's, you know, I'll compare this story to anybody's. So two stories. I'll disagree a little bit in the sense of like terrible things happened in their childhood. One got hit by a car; she wasn't that hurt badly. Another had scarlet fever. So, you know, these are not, I mean, what's devastating to me about this story is, it almost goes back to the Kafka discussion we had, is the ordinariness of it. Just the pure, you know, this is, they, okay, tough lives, tough economics, you know, and this is very much tracks my understanding of Barry Alt's own childhood. She had a brother, I'm not sure she had a sister. So it's a fascinating kind of inversion of your own life and kind of exploring your own life through a character who did not exist, I think. That's how I see it. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure. And yeah, the father never did very well, and her mother went blind. Those things are true very much in Barry Alt's own life. In this story, the older sister, the younger sister, the 7 year young sister who's 7 years younger, Delia, eventually leaves after her father's death and leaves her older sister to take care of her mother who's going blind. And leaves completely, cuts herself off, at least in the eyes of Fleur, the older sister, and her mother. But the truth is, and Delia kind of corrects this later in the story, she said, I did come back. came back as much as I could, and I sent money as much as I could. But yeah, I did leave, and I left you to take care of our mother. And Delia carries that weight to the end of the story, that her understanding is that Floor gave her life away for the care of her mother, and that Delia allowed that to happen. And now, in the present action of the story, Floor has come to live with Delia in San Francisco. And these are these incredible string of scenes that are almost, I mean, each one by themselves. Rereading it again today, I kept finding stuff that I maybe had missed because I was going too fast. But it's not an extraordinary situation. You know, we're not in a Stone Boy kind of story where you accidentally shoot your brother and then go and pick peas. That's weird. That, you know, this isn't that weird.
What's interesting too is how, and I guess I'm going to just jump right ahead to adulthood. There are big jumps in the story.
Big jumps.
Yeah. And so I feel like it's okay to jump ahead, but just what the differences between the girls. See, I'm having such a hard time with this, Peter. So, you know, this thing about one was hit by a car and one had scarlet fever. So I was talking about the story with someone who just offhandedly said, "You can't kill those girls," you know. And I thought about that, and I thought, yeah, except that there is so much else that's happening to them. Maybe that somehow that wasn't the worst thing that happened to them, which is incredible. And to me too, it's like it's almost. Is it the cumulative thing with them, the years and years that Floor had to endure taking care of the mother? But at the same time, I feel like even though Delia went away, she never really was away. The two of them, as children, even 7 years apart, they were bereft of the same kinds of things. Like they were sort of unified by that. They both recognized the same sorts of issues with their parents, it seems like.
I agree. Again, though, I mean, you know, this is an ordinary situation. You know, our parents aren't as successful as they had wanted to be, and therefore their lives reach their conclusions, and children are left sort of holding those expectations. I think the big difference in the story, and I think it's huge, is that Floor stays home and Delia does leave, because Delia at least gets to leave and insists on leaving. And I think what's so fascinating, this comes up in Burial, and you know, we've seen it before, and definitely in the other Delia story that I love so much, which is called what is it called? The one from Uncollected, about the tea ceremony.
Yes, the tea
Tea
ceremony.
ceremony. That's one of my absolute favorites of hers, and this is the same character, it seems. And Delia has gone out, you know, into the world, and it's not pretty. You know, she there's that scene where she's working as a maid for a family, and the kids hit her with a towel, you know, like they what they do in a locker room, you know. It's a horrible scene. But she actually tells Flora that to say, look, it wasn't all so great when I was out living in the world while you were at home. It was tough for me. And that said, Delia was out living in the world, and Delia did and continues to. That's why I think the story, as devastating and sad as it is not, I don't read this story as pure sorrow. I read it as a recognition of sorrow in the past. But Floor now is living with Delia in San Francisco, and we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And I feel like even though like I feel so not distraught, I just feel this weird ecstasy, really, of having known these characters, you know, and truly known them. And I think that is what makes the story, you know, so people might be shy away from a story that's not going to make them feel great. This story does feel make me feel great, weirdly. It makes me feel great because these characters were totally alive in ways that the 9 times out of 10, the things I read are not. And you know, maybe we need an example. And there's an example on every single sentence. But I'll just say, when she grew up, Delia still saw herself. This is very early in the story. This is the first time jump. I mean, Burial does time jumps here that, you know, that are Monroean. When she grew up, Delia still saw herself as outside the realm of music. And if you were a man interested enough to take her out on a date and talk to her about a famous pianist or sax player or a concert you'd been to, you'd wonder why she couldn't look you in the eyes at that point, and why she got clumsy, knocking a fork to the floor or tipping over her wine glass. Now, we don't really know Delia at that point in the story, but Barry gives us this, zooming way far into the future, zeroing in on what Delia wants, which is music. She wants to have the pleasure of music, and she feels, for whatever reason, economics definitely, cut off from music. And throughout the story, it's not just a metaphor, it's literal. She feels that she is almost not entitled to enjoy music in the same way that Floor wasn't entitled to sort of live a full life because of the family obligations that she had. And again, I think this is such a something that people feel, you know, cut off from the happiness that other people seem to experience when you're walking down the street. Why can't I have that?
And so for a time there was a violin in the house that had no piano. Floor never really asked for the violin. She never asked for anything. And so the granting of the violin seemed only to comply with the high school principal's decree that every student learn a musical instrument. The only thing Floor ever asked for was a pair of glasses so she could read the blackboard at school. So, you know, that this idea of the piano, okay, I can't talk. I'm sorry.
Hang on one sec. I gotta tell somebody to be quiet. Did you not? I got a recording in here. Thanks a lot. Awesome. Thanks. Hey, okay, sorry. You know, I get it. You know, I don't know. Well, tell me why. I mean, maybe I don't get it. Tell me why that's such a hard place to go.
Well, that's not why we read the stories and talk about them on The Lonely Voice, right? I mean, it's just like the things that I don't know.
But if something stops you and in your tracks, I mean, isn't that part of the deal? Isn't that part
Yeah.
of what we're doing?
Yeah, no, that Gina Barriault can write a story like this. And in 2024, here in Texas, you know, it can just knock. I don't, I've read this story 100 times. And there's just, you know what it is too for me is like this way that the sisters talk to each other in this very, what is the line? I know, I think you wrote about it, where she can only say a little bit at a time.
I mean, you know, when I mean, first of all, one thing we could say, and anybody with a sibling knows this, is that, you know, the communication that siblings have need not be specifically encapsulated into any particular words, right? My brother knows what I'm thinking by the tone of my voice, by the look on my face, even if his back was turned, and likewise. You know, I talked to him an hour ago. It's almost like we don't need words to talk, you know. And I think people with siblings know this. And he in this story, there's this remarkable scene where, at this point, Floor is, you know, grown up. Delia's grown up. Delia lives in San Francisco. The mother has died. Floor has joined Delia in San Francisco. She's got. I mean, you know, she had a tough time in school, and she's has a like apparently almost like a lazy eye or a cross-eyed or something where people made fun of her. I mean, she's had a very tough time and very you know, not associated with the community. You know, she was in the house with her mother all those years. So now she's in San Francisco, she's looking for a job, no one will hire her. And every night the two sisters sleep together side by side in twin beds. And then there's this paragraph. At certain times in the night, Fleur's breathing took on the sound of sorrow kept down in her breast, of sorrow that her young life had been taken from her while she'd hoped it was yet to come. And Delia said to her sleeping sister, "I had to leave. I had to find my own life, but it was never and may not ever be the life you thought I was enjoying. Mean things happened to me I never told you about. Not terrible things like Mama said were going to happen, just mean things that made life itself seem mean and you wonder why you're living it." And it goes on. And I, again, you know, she's not, this is not in dialogue and her sister's asleep and yet they're very much talking. You know, there's ways in which I think, you know, people who are incredibly close to each other can communicate, and it's you just rarely see it quite so beautifully presented on the page.
I do like Fleur's honesty right above that, where she says, "You never thought how hard it was on me." I mean, that's her point of view. And of course, we know Delia did consider her, but then. And further down is where it says, "Then Fleur turned away. She had so much to say, it could be said only a little at a time." That's the part I was thinking about. Now, at this stage of their lives, they have words. They have opportunity and space to say things to each other, but they still can't say everything. You know, the sister has to be asleep for the other one to articulate it. And there are things that each is still keeping close and not sharing. And I think that's just a very normal human survival thing. But it is interesting to see that now that the mother is gone, they have figured out this dark secret about the father. The question of the father, who the father's mother is.
Well, it all emerges in the context of these conversations. And I think it's so important what you were saying about just like so much to say, it could be said only a little at a time. And I cut to the next part, which is her response to that, Delia's response to Fleur's not being able to say all the things she needs to say. I think a lesser writer would like have this reckoning, like, you know, Fleur now comes to live and then they have it out. They have it out, you know, and I think in how it would really be is that, is it to be too hard to talk about all at once? You never would talk about it all at once.
Never.
You try a little bit at a time, but and Beryl knows that. And so, in the context of them having these sort of conversations in bed at night, you know, things start to emerge. And you know, one of the things that had to do with the father and the father's expectations not being met in his life, and one of the things that he endured was the fact that he was considered the black sheep of the family, Jewish family from Denver, where he's got a couple of accomplished brothers and he is not that accomplished. And they just make that really clear when they visit. They make it very clear to the, I'm losing my train of thought because I'm supposed to be in this whisper room and then they're talking outside. It's driving me crazy. It's the librarian. I can't yell at him. Anyway, but so I guess what I'm saying is, you know, things start to emerge and things that they haven't talked about. And so Fleur actually tells Delia something she didn't know, which is shocking. It's a big secret. But again, I think like it's not that big. You know, I mean, I guess it is big, but it doesn't overshadow the story. It doesn't.
No.
It's just a part of their nightly conversations. And that is that, you know, that pretty shockingly, her father's mother was her father's sister. In other words, Sophie, this character, had a baby and her parents adopted it.
Right.
So Delia and Fleur's father grew up with her, is basically his sister Sophie, who was really his mother Sophie. So it's twisted. Beryl does not, and again, this is the genius of her. She doesn't tell that story. Maybe had she lived longer and she was, you know, make a novel of that. That is really sort of just a fact now that the two sisters muse upon. And Delia takes that story. And it's remarkable. She takes that story and doesn't necessarily think of what that meant to her father, because he didn't know, presumably. Who did know was Sophie, his mother. And so she imagines Sophie's life, Delia does. And what's so beautiful is it is not squalid or it is not horrific. She actually imagines the good times that she had with that married doctor who is allegedly her father's father. I know this gets confusing, but it's not, she does not reach for darkness there. She reaches for a long embrace. And I thought that was just devastatingly beautiful.
Yeah, it's not sordid, and she allows herself to imagine how it could have happened, and she also imagines, I mean, she is her father's daughter, so she imagines, could there possibly be someone sitting in the cafe or walking down the street who's related to her?
Right.
I mean, that's so interesting to me, how she's trying to figure out who she is. I sense that these are two sisters who have always had an idea of what they want to be. And it's like they can't even really begin to ho hope for it because one, socioeconomically, they can't. They live in poverty. Their parents are not well off. They can't have a piano in the house. There are certain things that they cannot have and cannot do and cannot be about. There are certain worlds that they cannot enter. And it seems like Delia could leave the family and go away and begin to think that she could enter those spaces. And of course, we learn she can't because she's going to be a maid. And yet, she still has this sense of wanting to make a connection, even, and still interrogate who she really is. I think that part of it is so beautiful. And the scene, the bit about the sherbet
Yeah,
glasses,
I love that.
to me, I mean, to me, that becomes such a heartbeat of this story. Can you talk about?
Why don't you read that?
Okay. A hint of a bountiful future touched Fleur once more, as the violin had seemed to do. When Fleur took Delia to a movie matinee, Fleur's ticket won a complete set of sherbet goblets. Delia would hold one up to the light and imagine that someday they'd live in a very nice house where the amber goblets would really belong. Only tapioca pudding was eaten from them. Years later, when their mother died and Fleur came to live with Delia in her apartment in San Francisco, she brought along the three that were left of the goblets. And for the very first time in their lives, they ate sherbet. Sherbet is what the very rich eat between courses, Delia said. It cools their mouths. It sort of cleanses their taste for the next thing. I read that somewhere. It wasn't something she'd read. It was told her by a lover who knew a lot about what the rich did, but there was no point in telling her sister that small truth. Fleur was like truth itself, and other truths were negligible.
I mean, it's one of these paragraphs in this story that it goes so many places, that years later when their mother died and Fleur came to live with Delia, and she brings, that she brings them along. I mean, let me backtrack. What's so wonderful about this paragraph is that time moving forward years later when their mother died, and this wonderful, I mean, Fleur brings the goblets with her. Yeah, I just think that again, it's just these moments of such aching beauty that it really doesn't. The story's not swallowed by its sorrow.
No, I agree with you. And I feel like okay, I want to read this part because I don't know, in 2017 or so, at some point, 2018 or something, I wrote in the margins, my God, on page 102, where it says, with new clothes on, with a haircut, with lipstick on, Fleur went out to look for work. She never criticized the persons who turned her away. She accepted their indifference to her, their effacing of her, their edict that there was no place in the world where she was needed. She ate hardly anything because, she explained, she wasn't earning anything. Delia offered delicacies she had never bought for herself. And then Mama told me something, Fuller said one night, a voice from out of those isolating, effacing years. I don't know why she didn't tell you, unless because you went away. She said Sophie had a baby. And of course, Sophie is the father's mother, who they think is the sister. Delia sat up to hear. The world was opening wider than it had ever opened before. And closer than ever in that widening world was her sister Floor and Floor's voice. There's something so interesting to me about Floor's voice. And of course, by the time we get to the end of the story, and we knew that never had Delia heard Floor sing, I feel like Floor's voice is the replacement. This is so corny, for the music, for the piano, for the musical instrument that was such a symbol and such a standard for them in those homes. And of course, they didn't have one. I've kept sort of looking for this mention of the voice of Floor. And I don't know, it's just the same way that Floor can say just a little bit at a time. I feel like the whole story is like that. This is why I think you're right, that it doesn't, the sorrow, does, it's doesn't swallow you up. It's, you just get it in increments. And to me, it's so real. I feel like when you think about the years of a life or the stages of a relationship, even a sisterly relationship or a sibling relationship, I think this idea of this incremental knowledge or this incremental kind of communication or opening up, I think that's a very real thing in some families, not in all families, of course, but I think it's a very real thing in some families. And I also think that there isn't one single sordid, familial secret or skeleton that can emerge that will upend a family. Or I just feel like with this story, so many things are happening. Gets hit by a car, the scarlet fever, the mother goes blind, the father was the black sheep, Sophie this with the doctor. And there's one thing after another in this small, with the small group of people who happen to be related. And ultimately, I feel like all either sister really wants is what anybody wants.
Right.
Not a piano, not a reason to eat sherbet out of a goblet. Not that. Not any of that. Not any of that. And even Delia, who's able to go off, doesn't get anything more than Fuller herself has. It's like the further away she went from it, it just led right back to this connection, back to exactly what where Floor is.
Yeah, I mean I think he's just you kind of nail it. Like, the story has these sensational aspects, and yet there's nothing sensational about it. It is two sisters talking in the night, and they could be any two sisters, you know, because every family's got this stuff. And maybe not quite as, you know, incendiary as, you know, as the, you know, your father's mother being actually his sister. But Burial can take sensational things and make them subtle. Maybe that's something we should think more about in terms of other stories of hers, because I think that's it seems to be a thread. You know, she's able to humanize extraordinary things that happen and make them seem a lot more ordinary. And because for me, the heart of the story, and you mentioned that Floor doesn't talk a lot, and that's true, except for one moment fairly late in the story where she tells the story of her father's death, and it goes on about a little less than half a page. You remember the night they took Papa away to the charity hospital, said Floor. I went with him because Mama couldn't, and I was the oldest, and you stayed with her. And in the ambulance, they said he'd better sit up. That was best if you had a heart attack. I held his hand. He was cold, but he was sweating, and I thought he was sweating because he was afraid he was going to die. When we got there, they wouldn't take him up to the ward until he answered questions. I wished the nurse would stop asking so they could take him up and take care of him. He was sitting up like they told him to, and his chest was bare. It was glistening. I just think that, and this is something that Flor presumably has never told Delia, you know?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Flor has to deal with her father's death and the mother's death. And Delia, again, I mean, the only thing I think that we share these common things with our siblings, and yet our own trajectories determine kind of our distance from that. Flor had the distance. I think that makes Flor's life significantly different, even though she carries the same weight of these two parents. You know, and I think that that's what the, I think Delia carries the weight of not having been there,
Yes.
you know, which is almost like heavier in some ways, but
Yes.
also lighter in other ways because she didn't have to be there. I think the story's so much about kind of what we end up carrying because of what we hadn't done and we haven't experienced versus what we have. My brother was talking to me the other day about my father's death. And he was saying, telling me that he was in one hospital for a significant amount of time before he went home to hospice. And I have no recollection of that intermediary hospital. None. And that's because I wasn't there. My brother was. I think you can't avoid getting personal with this story.
And you know, so there on 101, where she says, "Do you remember that job I had, that one in the dime store?" And that's surprising to me that Fleur had a job. "I used to go in after school," Delia said, "and you'd slip me a chocolate. I was so proud. I had a sister who worked there. A man used to pick me out," said Fleur. "There were three girls, but he'd always ask me to wait on him. When I think about him now, he must have been what I am now, near 40, and I thought he was old. I mean, I was frightened he was so handsome. One day he wanted to walk partway home with me. I couldn't say he couldn't do that, so I walked in the wrong direction, a long way, with you and Mama waiting for me to come home. You know what I told him? I told him our mother was beautiful and our father was dead, and I said she liked to go out. Why did I say that about poor Mama?" Fleur, who seldom spoke, whose thoughts were so concealed that people figured she had none, told her lie about their mother to entice that stranger away from herself, down a wrong path away from Fleur, crazily struggling with desire one evening years ago. So, like this thing, even this was something that Delia had no idea about with Fleur. And Fleur is like, "Well, it's just poor Fleur who has to take care of everybody, and she's the older one, and she has this thing with her eye, and she maybe doesn't even know what it's like to have a lover and be out in the world." And then we see that she had this attention. It's not quite the same as, obviously, as having a lover and being out in the world and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, she's like, Delia, you think I haven't had a life? Well, let me tell you, I have had a life. Remember when I was at the dime store? And I mean, it's not, but it's something. It's something that, it's a
It's
story
something.
that they're sharing. Yeah, so
Yeah.
I hear you.
And
Yeah.
there's more, right? Because then she says, "After you left, she never wanted me to even go to the store, but I had to go and I tried to be back as soon as I could. Once a man in a car drove up alongside me as I was coming home. He asked me to go for a ride with him. It was summer. I had on a little sleeveless blouse and I wanted to go. I wanted to know." You know, it's like she had opportunity. She had attention. And granted, she was young. And these are apparently like older men, and they're, attracted to youth or whatever. But still, this is something that sometimes young girls go through. And for somebody like Fleur, this is what she has to look back on as, this thing, the secret she was keeping, but a way to say to her sister, "I had that attention too, but I stayed home with Mama."
And here's the thing. It's not pathetic.
No.
It might sound pathetic the way that we're putting it, but in the context of the story, it's not pathetic. It's the stories of a life, and they're limited, and there's not much to them. But that's these are life. These are the stories of someone's life, and I think Burial has this way of honoring them. And not make, I mean, yes, they're sad. And yes, they, on their face, they're pathetic. You know, and pathetic, and pathetic must have an origin of making that word better than it is now. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Some pathos in there, some, you know, so I mean pathetic in some other notion of, you know, what that word may have meant. You know, they are. These are, if this is what your life amounts to, is, you know, taking care of your blind mother, and some guy in a car once tried to pick you up, and you wanted to go, and you were wearing a cute dress, and then you didn't go. I mean, it's not much, right?
It's
But
not
there's
much.
something about it that doesn't, it on its face, it's not much. But in this story, and for Burial, and for Delia, it's a great deal. It's a great deal. And it, like, you kind of you basically said this, but like, Delia hadn't known. Now she knows. That her perception of her sister's life is not quite accurate.
Yeah, everybody had stolen pleasures, even Floor of a kind. And we haven't even talked about Mr. Bonner and the mother.
I mean, you know, and I think maybe we leave some stuff on the cutting room floor. You know what I mean? Because, but yeah, I mean, you know, and the father too. They danced. The mother and father danced, and that's indelibly printed in Delia's brain, you know, and all these things. And so, you know, it's like, yes, it's a sad story, but it's a story of, you know, of lives that are given dignity and fullness, even when on paper they shouldn't amount to a whole lot. This is one of Burial's longer stories, and it's dense. It's not easy. The sentences are odd. Sometimes the transitions are abrupt. It's, again, it's like nothing else. It's like nothing else. Even to my mind, even in her, you know, the only story I could compare it to is The Overcoat in terms of devastation.
Yeah.
And they're very similar, and they're back to back in this collection, Women in Their Beds. I'm just saying, this story has a complexity that's really hard to, it's not something that's sort of like you can't. You can't sort of explain it, you know. It has to be experienced, and I think I why is that? Because I think she was at the very height of her powers and trusted her instinct in a way that she, even in her other great stories, I feel like this one she really was like, you know what? I know how to do this, and I'm not playing by any other rules but my own.
I think what you said about how she, Burial, is able to write about these really ordinary characters, and there's a fullness, and there's a richness, and there's a dignity. I think that's why I'm so emotional about the story. I think that's why I'm all the stories in this book, frankly, but I think that's why it's so, there's so many people in this family. There's so many people in this story that she does that for. And I think just like the cumulative effect of that just like knocks me over. But that's really what it is. It's like I don't know what it is that I feel like her life was also, you know, had some of these same elements. And I don't know why that makes me so sad. But then also what she gives over to these characters, this amount of dignity and this amount of story. I just find that so moving. I can't even explain it.
I for some reason, my phone, I can't control it, but I know that I have very little battery left. So
Oh
I just wanted
man.
to give you, in case I disappear. But I
Okay.
think we covered it. I mean, honestly, I think we covered it, and I think we should talk about the ending. You know, the story does not end in any place other than just another moment of the two sisters sharing something that they hadn't known about each other's lives. And this is the mother's death. And you already alluded to this, but I heard a woman singing, said Delia that night. It was so beautiful, it made me cry. She's when she was walking home that night, Delia heard music on the radio and stopped and listened to it outside a window. It reminds me of something. I was in Chicago years ago and on the north side, just walking in a residential neighborhood, and somebody was playing piano, and I just stood on the sidewalk and listened for about five, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes. And I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. I was on North Pratt. But so Delia tells her that. I heard a woman singing, said Delia, that night it was so beautiful, it made me cry. That last night I was alone with Mama, Flora said. I was sitting by her bed, waiting for them to come and take her to the hospital, and I was singing quietly to myself. She asked me, "Why are you singing? What did you tell her?" I said I didn't know I was singing. And makes me think that I wonder if Burial wondered to herself, do I stop there? She doesn't, but she could have. Never had Delia heard Floor sing. Nobody else had ever heard Floor sing. Only their mother had once heard Floor sing. And now we're done.
I love that they remain mysteries to each other, and they will, and that's real, and that's true. They will remain, no matter how many long conversations they have deep into the night and what they share. We are all mysteries. We remain, and that's human, and that's how it should be.
But I also, but I imagine those further conversations and possibilities. Maybe this is how you, maybe this is how you turn it around, by ending the silence that had been for so many years. The silence is over. They're together now. I don't know. I feel like the story's almost beginning right now.
Gina Bariolt is the author of Stolen Pleasures. You can find it in the collection Women in Their Beds, published by Counterpoint, with an introduction by Peter Orner. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.